David, would you tell me about your earliest connections with the liquor industry and how you became associated with several of the distillers?
I was in public accounting in Louisville with a firm known as Umphrey Robinson and Company. And in 1928, or late 1927, a group of the pre-prohibition distillers got together to organize, to merge and organize a company to be known as American Medicinal Spirits Company. There were some 15 distillers went into this merger. The firm of Umphrey Robinson Company, my employer, was engaged to work out all of the details of this merger and to supervise the merger papers and install an accounting system to operate the business. One of the partners in the accounting firm, Mr. Henry C. Heimerdinger, was elected treasurer of the new corporation with the understanding that he would serve for 1 year to perfect the organization. He was an income tax specialist, and they were greatly concerned that they would do everything to avoid paying extra income tax, yet, of course, to comply with the tax law. Mr. Heimerdinger took me as his deputy to the office to do all the work. The office was then at the R.E. Wathman Company office out on Bernheim Lane. I spent the entire year then of 1928 working out all of the material and calculations preparatory to the creating of this new company.
Were you CPA at this point?
No, I was not a CPA at that point at all. I didn't get my CPA until 1932. This deal involved a determination of, as closely as you could obtain it, of the contents of all the barrels of whiskey that were in bond that were being turned into this merged company. In other words, a company, we'll just take as an example Old Grandad Distillery, which was one of the Wathen companies. They had so many barrels of whiskey in bond. They had the government to run a test regauge on this whiskey. A regauge is simply taking a barrel of whiskey, weighing it, proofing it, and calculating the amount of whiskey in the barrel. And when I use the term gallons, I'm speaking of proof gallons, 100 proof whiskey. When I use the term gallon, I always refer to it. It means proof gallons.
That was the only legal whiskey during Prohibition, right?
That's right. All this whiskey had been made prior to the fall of 1917, because in 1917, in World War I, under the Conservation of Grain Act, they stopped distillation. The government stopped distillation. It was never resumed until a prohibition came in 1920, but they never resumed distilling. These test gauges were made, I don't recall what percentage, but a very small percentage of the barrels were gauged. Maybe 10 barrels out of 500 or 1,000 or something, I don't remember now. Maybe it's more than that, maybe it's 5 out of 100. Anyway, they had the government regauge sheets. And my job was to calculate all these, the contents of the barrels gauged, and then project that into the total that company had in that warehouse to determine the total gallonage in all of these barrels. Say it was 10,000 barrels, just as an example. That gallonage formed the basis for them to receive so much stock in American Medicinal Spirits Company. this was quite a test. There was, as I recall, nearly 200,000 barrels involved altogether. So I spent many months, starting early 28 until in the summer of 1928, and I had one or two assistants working with me, making all these calculations. And in those days, we didn't have computers. We had some hand-cranked calculating machines, the only thing we had to work with, mostly paper and pencils. So that was my first obligation on this task.
Did you know anything about the quality of these 200,000?
No, we knew nothing about the quality. It was all assumed to be good, bad, good and bad. Good and better, maybe. Maybe I should say good and better. The question was how much was in the barrels,
yeah.
How much is evaporated, how much had leaked out.
Sure.
You see, at this point, a lot of this whiskey had been hauled around from one warehouse to the other. Prior to that date, there had been a concentration act passed by the government. Because too many of the little distillers out in the country were stealing their whiskey mm-hmm. and bootlegging it.
They did that in Louisville too, I understand.
Some in the city. But it was more difficult for the government to supervise a lot of little distillery warehouses scattered all over the state. So they conceived the idea of bringing this whiskey in to larger centers, larger warehouses. They weren't all in Louisville. Most of it were brought into warehouses and stored in Louisville.
How many approximately were there in Jefferson County or in the Louisville area in general?
I really don't remember. I just can't remember. But there was a lot of whiskey brought into the what was then Kentucky Distillers and Warehouse Company's warehouses up on Lexington Road. Mm-hmm. There was a big warehouse up there that I think it was supposed to hold 75 or 100,000 barrels of whiskey, which was then considered the largest whiskey warehouse in the world. And it would been all kinds of whiskey had been brought and stored in there from out in the state. Whiskey was stored at Sunnybrook warehouses down at 28th and Broadway. There was some big warehouses there, and there was whiskey brought in from out in the state and stored at those warehouses.
Did distillers have any choice which warehouse their product would go?
I presume they did. I don't really know. There was other whiskey stored up at Old Taylor at Frankfort and different warehouses around. But this whiskey had been hauled around. Some had been moved mm-hmm. more than once.
Mm-hmm. Moved too much in some cases.
And that was always suspected it would absorb more, getting on the dry staves and all would lose more. But this was calculated, and we arrived at how much stock everybody was supposed to get out of this deal in exchange for the barrels of whiskey that they were turning in to the merger. My next task then was to unify an accounting system. Up till then, we had been operating in the office with about four or five different groups. Everybody running his own show like he had been running it before. There was no coordination between old granddad and Hill and Hill from Owensboro and KD&W. Everybody was over in this one corner running his business. Another gang was over in another corner running his business. Everybody was going along like they always had. So it fell my lot to unify the accounting system and to get one person in charge to keep the records.
Was the tax collection somewhat in a shambles as well?
No, I wouldn't say that was in a shambles. That was, of course, at that point, as I remember, the federal excise tax was 90 cents a gallon. I believe it's $10 and a half today.
Mm-hmm. And going up.
Going up some more. But it was, as I recall, it was 90 cents or $1.10. Then became $1.10 about that time. I guess it was $1.10 by 28. They were bottling for medicinal purposes, shipping. There was a bottling plant running out at the R.E. Wathen plant. There was one running at the Kentucky Distillers and Warehouse plant on Lexington Road. And possibly in some of the others, I don't remember. Bottling whiskey, sell it into the medicinal trade.
Was there much, if I may interject a second, to your knowledge, was there much glass produced locally for bottling, or was it primarily glass, say, out of Owings, Illinois?
Well, I think it was all out of Owings, Illinois. If there was any glass bottles produced in Louisville, I don't recall it at all. I think all the glassware was shipped in here from some other. I think Owings, Illinois probably had the lion's share of it, as I remember. I didn't, that was just not quite my job to keep up with. But anyhow, late in 1928, I succeeded in getting the records in what we considered an acceptable condition, but a young man who had been, came up here from Owensboro, Jim Whalen, in charge of the accounting and the bookkeeping. I selected him. There were some, most of the distillers had horrible records. They had been just noted for their horrible record keeping.
Did they do that rather intentionally? Or
no, I just don't know.
Just bad business.
Well, you see, they didn't, as independents, really as operators, they didn't go too, hadn't been in business too long beyond the advent of the first federal income tax in March in 1912. Mm-hmm. Prior to 1912, nobody bothered about keeping records anyhow. The tax law forced a lot of record keeping, and they hadn't grown far enough along to really greatly improve record keeping from the advent of the first federal income tax law of March 1, 1912, I believe it was. Anyhow, the bookkeepers that they had were usually old fuddy-duddies that didn't know a debit from a credit. They had learned that they'd put a pink piece of paper here and a blue piece here, and that's about all they knew. I was the first supposed to use the bookkeeper for the R.E. Wathen and Company. He was a hopeless character. He didn't know anything about bookkeeping at all in my books. Of course, Mr. R.E. Wathen was the president of the combined company. And his feelings were rather strong that his people should get the good deals. And I had my problems to negotiate to bring this young kid, Jimmy Whalen was in his late 20s, I guess. He'd come up from Hill and Hill in Owensboro. He'd been the bookkeeper at Hill and Hill in Owensboro, one of the smaller units that went into the merger. But I'd become convinced that he was the most capable and a young man that could learn and would listen to me. And through the help of Mrs. Bachman, who was the secretary of the corporation and had been an executive with Kentucky Distilleries and Warehouse Company, I first sold Mrs. Bachman on what I wanted, and she helped me sell Mr. R.E. Wathen. So we put young Whalen in charge of the accounting. Much later on, he went to New York with National Distillers, continued, I suppose, I don't know whether he's still alive or not, at least last I ever heard of him many years ago, he was in New York with National Distillers. He was one of their top assistant controller of National Distillers, or something of that nature. But that was my first connection with the distillery business. Now,
true accountants were apparently pretty rare at this point.
Beg pardon?
In that industry, true accountants.
Well, there were practically none, because none of these companies had had audits made much. Mm. Now, R.E. Wathen had had audits made by Mr. Escott, Hap Escott's father, Escott Barnett and Company. They weren't what I considered very good books anyhow. And nobody else had very good books. I don't know whether any of the other companies had ever had an audit made. There was a group of people. Old Taylor was one of the larger units that came into this. It was owned by Mr. Emil Schwartzhoff and Leo Gerngross. F.S. Ashbrook and Company at Cintiana was another one that came in. Owned by Lester Jacoby, who later on became president of Shanley Distillers. Sunnybrook Distillery joined in this merger. It was owned by a man named Rosenfield in Chicago. Joe Rosenfield owned it. And it was in Chicago, he was in Chicago. There was a lot of interesting characters among these old-time distillers that I met in this process down there, out there.
You want to give us a couple character sketches?
Well, Dan Weisskopf was probably the biggest character of the bunch. See, Kentucky Distilleries and Warehouse Company had been known as the Whiskey Trust. It had been involved in antitrust litigation at one time in pre-prohibition days. It had gone through Kentucky and bought up all the little country distilleries at some time. I don't know just when that occurred. It had been gradually slimmed down in 1928. It still had a lot of whiskey, probably more than it had more, I guess, than anyone else that went into the merger. And as I remember, it was owned by U.S. Industrial Alcohol at that time, which was a company engaged in producing commercial alcohol out of blackstrap molasses. They were not in Kentucky. They were, I don't know where they operated, honestly. Headquarters was in New York, at least. Through these, Weisskopf was a very interesting old character. I couldn't say anything too good about him, so I'd better not talk about
it. Not even a tidbit.
He was out looking out for Weisskopf, number one. The Wathen family were very charming people. Mr. R.E. and Mr. O.H. and Mr. J.B. Wathen were brothers. They had been our clients in the public accounting firm, and I personally handled a lot of their income tax returns and material like that for them. They were very charming, genteel gentlemen, all of them were. Mrs. Bachman was a very interesting person. She had started as a teenager working for Bernheim Distilling Company and then went to Kentucky Distilleries and Warehouse Company and had continued there until this merger took place. She was, I don't know her age at that time, but she was probably in her 50s. And she continued with National Distillers until she retired. So she spent her entire lifetime in the liquor industry.
She, if I recall right, you told me on another occasion that she somewhat tutored you in the business.
Oh, yes.
Period.
She was my tutor in a lot of the technical aspects of the liquor business. I relied on her to gain a lot of knowledge, the technical knowledge that I gained through this engagement on taxes and how you, the government regulations that you had to comply with, and a great deal of that. I obtained all of that information, nearly all of it, from Mrs. Bachman. I spent many hours in her office just talking with her to gain information. She was a very delightful person and was a great friend of mine in those days. So that got the
company. Were there any other characters that I could interject with? Any other character sketches you
Well, no. That I met. This is where I met Mr. Schwartzoff and Mr. Gerngross. Mm-hmm. They were both vice presidents. American Distill had more vice presidents than a New York bank. Everybody from all these distilleries ended up as a vice president. I don't know how many they did have. They had so many of them. Well, they gradually started falling by the wayside and getting out one way or another. But that was the situation. Now, as I say, they controlled the vast majority of the whiskey in the United States, this company did. I suspect 75 or 80% of all the whiskey and bond in the United States, they had it under control. I don't, at the time I had figures that I could have been certain of that number, but I'm quoting somewhat from memory, mm-hmm. and that's many years ago now. Then, following my completion of this engagement, I continued for the next few years making an annual audit for, by accounting firm, for American Distilled Spirits Company. Always accumulating more information regarding operations in a distillery, what the terms and all of these things were. In 1929, I believe it was, fall of 29, the Prohibition Administrator, in his wisdom, decided that if they didn't make some more whiskey and get it aged, that the pneumonia patients would suffer without any medicine. They'd run out of whiskey, and there wouldn't be any good pneumonia medicine left. So there was an authorization.
He was definitely on the side of the consumer's health, right?
That's right. Take good care of the consumer's health. So he authorized a production, and as I recall the number of 2 million gallons, I may be wrong on the quantity, but my best memory is it was about 2 million gallons to be made, which is just a drop in the bucket today, but that was considered a pretty good lot of whiskey at that point. And he allocated it out to various existing companies based on their current holdings of whiskey and having a facility available to make whiskey. Because you mind, these plants hadn't been run since 1917. They'd been sitting mothballs for 12 years there. And most of them had been torn down. The great majority of the plants had actually been physically wrecked. And most of the machinery was in Carl Nussbaum's junkyard here in Louisville. Mm. He had more distillery machinery than anybody else in the world. But American Medicinal, because of their dominant position, received the largest share of this 2 million gallons. I don't remember the quantity, but I'm sure that it was more than a million of the two. That whiskey was distilled, as I recall, at the R.E. Wathen plant on Burnheim Lane. Then, a couple of years later, Dr. Doran, who was then Prohibition Administrator in Washington, was considering whether he'd better make some more whiskey. This was probably about 1931, I think it was, late 30 or 31.
There were real shortages, though, right? To your knowledge, I mean, there was a real need to make some more, in terms of the demand of the times.
Maybe.
Maybe, okay.
Anyhow, my good client, American Medicinal Spirits Company, didn't see it that way. They saw their opportunity controlling the great bulk of whiskey in the United States in their control. They saw the opportunity to put the squeeze on everybody else, I'm sure. So they opposed Dr. Doran in issuing this additional quota of production. I received, my boss, rather, Humphrey Robinson Company, received a call one morning from Mr. R.E. Wathen, who was in Washington, D.C. And I had, from all of my studies that I had made in 28 of the contents of these barrels, was always suspect as to what was left in the barrels. Mm-hmm. Dr. Doran didn't have any idea whether these barrels were a third full or a quarter full or half full or empty. He knew how many barrels there were, but he didn't know what was in the barrels, see. Now, I had this great pile of statistics on this 28 regauge and calculations. And I had in my office probably the most authoritative information in the United States on what the barrels contained that were in bond.
You were ready.
So Mr. R.E. Wathen was in Washington, called my boss and asked him to have me to get all these statistics and come to Washington as soon as I could to meet him at the Willard Hotel where he was staying, and he would have reservations at the Willard Hotel for me. Be prepared to, we were being to be prepared to combat Dr. Doran if he came up with wanting to make whiskey. We would be prepared to say, Dr. Doran, there's X millions of gallons of whiskey already in bond. You know what's being used, and that will run an awful long time at the present consumption levels. And I was to help bat this down. Well, I did as I was instructed to do and got to Washington. Mr. Wathen and my old friend Dan Weisskopf were there. They were the two that were there. Mr. Wathen said, Mr. Shaver, Dr. Doran isn't ready to talk yet. He's still gathering statistics. So I'll keep in contact, and you keep in contact with me. You just go ahead and have a good time. It may be several days before he's interested in talking to us. He said, check with me every day, and I'll keep you up on the progress. So I would check with him, and he'd say, no, nothing doing today. Go ahead and enjoy yourself. So I had an expense-paid sightseeing tour of Washington, D.C., and all the interesting sites in the radius of Washington. I stayed about 10 days, rode all the sightseeing buses, and went to Arlington, went out to Washington's birthplace, well, you name it, I went everywhere. And every day I was checking. Finally, on one Saturday morning, I called Mr. Wathen, as I did early in the morning, and he said, come up to my suite and let's have breakfast together. I'm ready to talk with you about something. So I did, and I got up there, and he said, Dr. Doran decided late yesterday afternoon that there was sufficient whiskey in bond and he would not authorize another production. So we've won without having any problems. So you just get on the train, go back to Louisville, which I did. So that stopped, there was no more production. The next production that was authorized was in 1933 when they authorized Bernheim Distilling in Louisville, who was had gone in business, remodeled the distillery at 17th and Breck, and in October of 1933 they received a permit from the alcohol tax unit to start distilling whiskey. That was, so far as I know, the first whiskey that was distilled just in the United States, just preceding repeal on December the 5th, 33. Bernheim made its first whiskey on October 31st, 1933 at distillery number one. There was two distilleries at that site, registered distillery number one and number two in the United States. Number two made its first run on December the 12th, which was 7 days following repeal.
Very interesting.
Now, I want to back up a minute, and I suspect that there's not many people around here in Kentucky that knows this story. That I found out this in 1928, and this is one company that merged in the American Medicinal Spirits, known as Hannis Distilling Company in Maryland. They had made whiskey, and as I recall, about 10,000 barrels after repeal in 1921 or 22, probably some in 21 and 22. The owners of this company and their attorneys, and incidentally the president's name was Hannis, and I happen to know Mr. Hannis, concluded that the Prohibition Volstead Act did not prohibit the manufacture of whiskey, but prohibited the sale for beverage purposes only. So they started up their distillery in Maryland making whiskey. I think it was rye, as I remember, rye whiskey. Before the government, and they quit fighting in the courthouse over whether they could or could not, they had made about 10,000 barrels. They lost the suit, and the government made them close down. Now,
did they make them pay tax?
Well, it was made in bond like anything else, sure. It was all legal. This wasn't bootleg. It was made in bond just like any other whiskey was made. And when it was taken out of bond, the prevailing tax was paid at that time, of course, on it. But so far as I know, that's the only whiskey that was legally distilled in the United States from fall of 1917 until this allocation was made by Dr. Doran in 1929.
That's an interesting start.
If there was any other, I never heard of it, at least. Now, I'm talking about legal. Now, there was lots of it made back in the woods around through Kentucky. Up Ever Hollow was whiskey being made. But it was not legal whiskey. This was legal under law.
Very interesting.
Now, you on?
Yeah.
A short time before repeal, as I recall, American Medicinal Spirits Company merged with National Distillers and became National Distillers. I also, based on the best memory I have, is that National Distillers shortly after the American Medicinal merged with National Distillers, Emil Schwartzoff and Leo Gerngross, who were vice presidents, resigned from National Distillers and decided to go into the liquor business on their own. They came to Louisville and first bought the two distilleries owned by Max Seliger and Company at 17th and Breckenridge Street, one known as Astor and one as Belmont. These old distilleries had been idle, of course, since 1917. There was no whiskey left in the warehouses. I'm not sure what became of the whiskey that had been there. But based on my memory, I think I was told that they had taken this whiskey to Mexico before Prohibition came in, that they had hauled all their whiskey to Mexico. I also understood that a number of other small distilleries in Kentucky, particularly over around Lawrenceburg, Kentucky, took their whiskey to Mexico. What they did with it then, I don't know. Anyhow, there was no whiskey at the plant at 17th and Breckenridge Street. Old buildings that had been sitting there idle and accumulating dirt and mess since 1917. They immediately entered into agreements and contracts to remodel these two plants, this plant, and get it back into production to make whiskey again. Then they bought the Bernheim Distilling Company, which had long since abandoned all of their properties. And they owned, as I recall, about 6,000 barrels of whiskey that was stored in the KD&W warehouses on Lexington Road. The KD&W bottling plant was bottling whiskey, I.W. Harper, for them, and they were selling it into the medicinal trade. The Bernheim family, so far as I know, had long been out of the Bernheim Distilling Company. I don't know whether they owned any of it or not. I wasn't in on that. The president was Lewis Cole, who was a nephew of Mr. I.W. Bernheim. I'm positive that by that time, Mr. I.W. Bernheim was living in Denver, Colorado. He had had a falling out with his the Jewish community of Louisville, and he made the statement at one time, I'm told, that he was shaking all the Louisville dirt off his feet and would never come back again, and I don't think he ever did.
Do you know the nature of his dispute with the community?
I don't know. Anyhow, I never saw I.W. Bernheim. But when Mr. Schwartzoff and Gerngross made this move to Louisville, they came to Humphrey Robinson Company and inquired whether I was still on the staff, and I was. They had remembered me from the work that I had done in 1928 at American Medicinal Spirits Company. They asked my boss if they would assign me to handle their accounting in Louisville and make a monthly audit of their records and give them a monthly financial report on their operations in Loyal, which I began to do in mid-1933, I presume it was. They proceeded with the modernization or remodeling of the old distilleries at 17th and Breckenridge. And then they were ready to start. They obtained registry number one and number two in the whole United States. The Astor plant was re-registered as distillery number one, and the Belmont was re-registered as distillery number two. They were ready to start and operate number one before the effective date of repeal. So in October of 1933, they obtained from the Prohibition Administrator a permit to distill, even though Prohibition was still in force. And they started number one, and the first whiskey was drawn on October 31st, 1933. Number two was not quite ready to resume operations at that time, but it did resume, and the first whiskey was drawn from that, in that distillery, on December the 12th, 1933, or 7 days after repeal of Prohibition. In the spring of 1934, in my professional duties in public accounting, I had to prepare income tax returns for the Wathans. Mr. O.H. Wathan and Mr. R.E. Wathan had both moved to New York with National Distillers. And I had to go to New York to prepare the income tax return for Mr. O.H. Wathan. He had been quite successful that year because the market for National Distillers stock had skyrocketed during 1933. Early in 1933, the stock was selling, I don't know just how low, I know at one time it was 17. And within about 3 months it was 125. Mm. It had
quite a turnaround for this period.
Then it dropped back pretty rapidly to settle down pretty steady around $80 or $85 a share. I failed to make any money because while I knew what was going on, and I was often in their National Distillers office here in Louisville. And my good friend Ms. Bachman told me that, said, Shaver, I know you lost your money in the stock market crash at 29. If you've got anything left, buy our stock and you'll get the money back that you have lost. Mm. Well, a burned child dreads the fire, and I'd been in the fire, and I had cooled off very well. The stock at that time was selling at 17 the day she told me that. A few weeks later, I was in her office, and she had a telephone conversation while I was sitting at her desk, and I knew she was talking to a broker. When she finished her conversation, she pulled out the drawer of her desk and threw a certificate for 100 shares of National Distiller stock out on the top of her desk, and she said, Shaver, did you do what I told you to do and buy our stock? I said, no. She said, well, why didn't you? I just sold that for $25 a share. I said, well, I missed it then. A month later, it was $125. I was back out there after that, and I said, she said again, did you ever buy any of this stock? I said, no. She said, well, why didn't you? And I said, why in the devil did you sell it at 25 when I was sitting here at your desk? Then she confessed that she had bought and sold several times on the way up and really hadn't made much money herself. Well, that's sidelight. But in the spring of 34, when I went to New York to prepare Mr. O.H. Wathan's income tax return for 1933, and that was quite a chore because he was not known for keeping many records, and he had traded with brokers all over the United States that year. I found a broker even in Salt Lake City he had bought some stock from. He didn't even know he'd ever been to Salt Lake City. But in the process, I finally got a tax return made up for him. It apparently passed muster. But Schwartzhoff and Gerngross had an office. At that time, National Distillers was at 52 William Street, just off a wall. They had an office at 52 William Street in the same building. Naturally, they were my client, and in another direction, but I visited them, went to their office several times to have conversations. And in the process, before I was coming back to Louisville, I told them that they were building up, starting to get the big business built, and they had no accounting personnel. And I would like to work for them. They were Germans and spoke with very broken, very accent. And they said, "Oh, well, Mr. Schaefer." You know, they never called me Schaefer, they called me Mr. Schaefer. "Oh, well, Mr. Schaefer, we would so much like to have you work for us. We will talk about it." "Thank you, sir." So I came back to Louisville. A few weeks later, Mr. Gerngross was in Louisville, and he called me, and he said, "Mr. Schaefer, when you was in New York, you told Ableton and me that you would like to work for us. Was you serious?" I said, "Very serious, Mr. Gerngross." "Oh, well, we've discussed it. We want you to come to work with us as soon as you can." As a result of that conversation, I became employed as their chief accountant at Burndown Distilling Company on July the 15th, 1934. And I continued in the liquor business until July of 1942 with that organization. We grew rapidly, highly successful financially, built the buildings, the warehouses, bottling plant and all that is now at 17th and Breckenridge Street.
Can you tell me something about the production at that plant, roughly?
Yes. We had a production at that plant, as I recall, about 450 barrels a day. When I left the company in 42, we had something like 350,000 barrels of whiskey and bond in the warehouses at that point. We had not, in 1937, they sold the business to Shanley Distillers. The deal was closed during the Great Flood of 1937, mm-hmm. in the spring of 37.
Did the flood precipitate the...
No, it had nothing to do with it. The deal was all really signed and sealed before the flood. The flood did not do us too awful much damage. There was something like 30,000 barrels of whiskey in the water. Some of it floated out of the racks and got a lot of oil and stuff on the barrels. Varnish. The Louisville Varnish Company was just a couple of blocks away that burned during the flood, and varnish got mixed up with the water. And boats and things running around got oil in the water. So one of our biggest troubles was we had a lot of barrels that had a combination of oil and varnish on them when we got the water out of the warehouses. That was all right. We salvaged it. We had to do a lot of cleanup. It cost us a lot of labor to clean these barrels.
But it did not penetrate the barrels.
They did not penetrate the barrels, as far as we knew. We never determined that, at least. We lost. There were a few barrels floating around. It ran into things and broke up and lost the contents. I don't think we lost the contents of over 8 or 10 barrels, and there was something like 30,000 barrels in the water. But only 8 or 10, as I recall, we actually lost the whole contents. Again there, because of the accident and all, we were able to get the government to abate the tax. Mm-hmm. On the whiskey that was unavoidably destroyed. They abated the tax, and we were not penalized for having to pay tax.
I understand that some barrels were used as for pontoon bridges.
Oh, yes.
Do you know anything about that?
Oh, yes, I know a lot about it. None of those came from Burnheim, but there were, because we didn't have a bottling house. We didn't start building a bottling house until after we sold out to Shenley in 37. But the whiskey being bottled in all the other bottling houses around Louisville were emptying barrels. And during the Great Flood, there was a pontoon bridge built on Baxter Avenue where the L&N crosses Baxter Avenue at the Baxter Avenue station. Mm-hmm. There was a long pontoon bridge built because the river was not up at Main Street or down there is high. Nobody realized it. But then the water was in Beargrass Creek and along the railroad station. It was very deep there. So there was a bridge built on Baxter Avenue out of whiskey barrels. A pontoon bridge floated on whiskey, old emptied whiskey barrels. And those barrels, I'm quite sure, came from the KD&W bottling house, which is up on Lexington Road, because that was a big bottling house then. I'm sure that that's what happened there. Going ahead with my story, I went with Bernheim, and at that point, we were distilling whiskey. I studied and worked on all and set up what I considered, still considering, what was considered by people in Newark as one of the best accounting systems that anybody had seen in a whiskey, in a distillery at Bernheim.
Can you tell us about that system, the format for the system?
Well, I don't know that there's anything in particular that I can tell you about it. We didn't have computers. They hadn't been invented. All those things, all this records were hand-kept. There was one, the basic record that you had to keep whether you wanted to or not. Not but.
But some people say that the fact that there was a 5-cent production tax actually chased out the development of other liquor distilling, vodka and so forth, so that it had a long term, according to this allegation, a long term adverse effect upon total distilling in Kentucky. What is your opinion?
Well, of course, this is just one man's opinion. I don't think so. I don't think the people who were engaged in the distilling industry in Kentucky believed in making anything but bourbon whiskey. Nobody else took the bourbon whiskey away from Kentucky, really. It was still controlled, the bourbon whiskey distillation. I don't think the people in the industry here was the least bit interested in making, well, vodka was unheard of at that point, practically. Mm-hmm. It's nothing but green alcohol to begin with. Mm-hmm. Gin, the people that were in the whiskey business here were not interested in gin in those days. They were considered a bunch of dogs, and nobody would fool with that kind of slop. The old-time people that were in the whiskey business here considered nothing but bourbon as an acceptable beverage. I doubt if they would have gone into any of these other things at that point. Now, later on, maybe so. I don't know when they repeal this production tax. I understand there is no production tax today.
It occurred in the mid-60s. It was repealed, phased down, okay, over a number of years.
Well, I lost, of course, since 1942. It was still a nickel in 1942, mm-hmm. I don't know what happened since then. A higher tax probably would have hurt worse. 10 cents probably hurt 10 times as bad as 5 cents. But I don't think it really did. I don't believe these people were too steeped in the idea of bourbon whiskey. Now, you know, bourbon whiskey, by definition, is 51% corn. Mm-hmm. At Bernheim, we made what we call 40% small grain. We use 60% corn, 40% barley malt and rye. I've forgotten the breakup between rye and barley malt now. But they varied anywhere around in that neighborhood. Some of them ran higher corn and lower small grain than we did. But basically that's what was going on. I think another copy was filed with the Alcohol Tax Unit of the U.S. Treasury Department. I don't know what came of all. How many copies there were now? I've forgotten. But we got.
The storekeeper Gager's entire salary was paid by the federal government.
Oh yes,
correct?
Storekeeper Gager was an employee of the Alcohol Tax Unit of the Treasury Department.
Mm-hmm. He carried. Well paid?
I don't know. I haven't the slightest idea. I'm sure they were overpaid, whatever it was. But. But it, no, they were pretty decent characters as a rule. But anyway, they carried the keys to everything. Mm-hmm. Everything was locked up. And they carried the keys to the warehouses. They carried the keys all the way through to the cisterns where you were filling. They were present when you were doing anything. So anyhow.
They were tough.
Yeah, some of them could be awful ornery. Most of them were pretty decent Joes. But you filled your barrels. He prepared this. We got a copy. And then we proceeded to write the critical information in the crop book from this sheet of paper, which was about 16, 18 inches long and 12 inches wide, I guess. Was known as a regage form. And that was then by hand written into this crop book. The date and the and it also showed in the crop book where we stored the barrels, the location. That came in to us from the warehouse people, and we put on there where the barrels were located in the warehouse, what warehouse and what tier and all of this, so we could find that barrel when we went out and looked for it. The barrels were then rolled to the warehouse and stored in the racks. We had a record in this crop book. Whatever happened to that whiskey, we recorded it in this crop book. If we at Bernheim, what we were doing, we were selling green whiskey right after as fast as made on warehouse receipts. We sold all of the whiskey that was made in distillery number one, and we kept all that was made at number two for our own use. In the crop book, we recorded who purchased certain barrels and the warehouse receipt number that it was issued on that whiskey. Now, if later on it was transferred to someone else and we had to change it over in the crop book. But the crop book was the basic record of what was in the warehouses. Every barrel was in there, and we knew it. The storekeeper, Gager, kept this. We kept a control sheet of how many barrels and how many proof gallons that we had in the warehouses, of course, and what we sold, and we knew what was left always. The other, just ordinary financial records, payroll records and general ledgers and cash books and things were of my design, which was rather advanced compared to what these people had used heretofore, because they hadn't kept much records, except the dear old crop book. It was the critical record in the distillery, the crop book was.
So you provided a standard, really, for the industry locally.
That's right. And but I had also, in my practice of public accounting, had worked on audits for Frankfurt distilleries and other distilleries along the way. So I presume that at the time of repeal, that I'd had more exposure to distillery accounting than any public accountant in the United States, and had more experience in that field probably than any other public accountant in the United States. But then continuing at Bernheim as we grew and prospered, I learned a lot about the manufacturing process, which I hadn't known before. However, we had a very fine distiller. That was his prerogative. That was none of my business. But Wathen Naval Camp, I learned a lot from him about that, the government rules for operating and all of these things. We were not going to bottle any whiskey till it became 4 years old. Now, we did some quick aging, what was called quick aging, right after repeal, when our customers wanted to buy this green whiskey and wanted us to quick age it, and they would draw it out of the warehouse and take it somewhere else and bottle it and try to sell it to people. And we did what we call goosenecking. Well, it wasn't any good. It didn't do any good. It is a failure, actually, but it is better than nothing, I guess. Anyway, people would buy the stuff. So we sold a lot of goosenecked whiskey.
Would you define that gooseneck, please?
Well, the barrel was the bung-up barrel, and we had a copper thing you screwed in the bung. And you put steam in there, and then there was a condenser on there, and you run steam in there, and the vapor would come up in this condenser, and you'd stir it around in the barrel so it'd turn brown a little bit. See, it gets some color on it. It didn't improve the taste of it a bit, but it added.
It looked good.
It made it look good. It made it look like whiskey, because you see, when whiskey's distilled, it's clear. Mm-hmm. There's no color to it. Mm-hmm. So you got it. This gooseneck, and you got it colored up a little bit, so it looked like whiskey at least, even though it didn't taste like it. But we didn't do much of that. I remember one time, we'd been in business, been running about 6 or 8 months. And Mr. Gerngross came down and told one of the men there in the office, send over in the warehouse, get storekeeper Gager to get a couple of pints of samples out of 2 barrels of that old whiskey we've got. It is 6 months old. That old whiskey was 6 months old. He wanted to see how it is aging and whether he could drink it or not. We always laughed about him getting that old whiskey that was 6 months old. But anyway, we went on filling up warehouses, selling warehouse receipts. I got to know through, we didn't have a very big staff. Mr. Schwartzoff, Mr. Gerngross did all the selling practically. Schwartzoff could sell out of production. What we generally did, we'd go to a dealer, and we'd sell him so many barrels a month out of each crop, spring and fall crop. We put a company here in Louisville, known as Kentucky Parfait, Mr. Radford's in business. We started selling him 5 barrels a month. He didn't have any money. We financed it. The buyer paid us, as I recall, $5 a barrel down, and then $2.50 every 6 months. We held the warehouse receipts as collateral on the notes as security. Before he could take any whiskey out, he had to pay up any unpaid balance. Mr. Radford prospered. We got to selling him several hundred barrels a month. Finally, when the whiskey became 4 years old, we bottled it under a brand known as Kentucky Par, which he sold at retail in Louisville as a wholesaler, and he made a substantial amount of money out of it. But we accumulated a good many million dollars worth of notes to finance this whiskey. We had adequate financing with banks in Chicago and other places.
Did you have trouble with that? I understand that the distillers, that there was problem with local funding financing.
Well, the banks here in Louisville, none of them were near big enough to handle a deal like this. Actually, we had our principal financing with the First National in Chicago. It was where we had a line of credit of, I think, $5 million with the First National in Chicago. One bank in Louisville could give you a line of credit for $5 million.
Did you get credit also out of Cincinnati or some of the other?
I don't think so. As I remember, out of New York and Chicago principally. First National Chicago was our principal account. But anyhow, this built up, and then we sold out to Shanley Distillers in spring of 1937. And then we had made whiskey in 33, so we were getting, at that fall, we'd have 4-year-old whiskey. Mm-hmm. So they then proceeded to build a bottling house, which is down there today. And we started bottling the end of 37 or early 38. I don't remember when the bottling house was completed until early 38. I think it was late 37. And we started our bottling operation then.
Could I interject at this point? Can you tell me anything about the acquisition by Shanley, the terms, anything about the reasons for the acquisition?
I don't remember the detail, all of it, but Schwartzoff and Gerngross were not operating men, honestly. They were traders. They had started out during Prohibition trading in warehouse receipts for whiskey, buying and selling and trading in warehouse receipts. They were not, by temperament or disposition, operating people. They were traders. this business was growing beyond their ability to operate it. They were worried about financing this great growth, because at this time we were in debt, $5, $6, $7 million, I guess, we had borrowed, and that was a lot of money. The equity was getting thin, and Shanley wanted all that. We had a lot of whiskey, and this fine plant here is one of the top quality plant. So they made a deal with Shanley and took stock in Shanley Distillers. As I recall, at the time that deal was made, Schwartzhoff and Company, they had a partnership known as Schwartzhoff and Company. Schwartzhoff and Company owned 1/6 of all the stock in Shanley. They had 1/6 of the Shanley stock, as I recall the figures. And that was 200 and some odd thousand shares, as I recall. Shanley didn't have an awful lot of shares outstanding then. But I think they owned about 1/6 of all the outstanding stock at Shanley. They nominally were, for a while, were officers in Shanley, but they pretty well, they didn't stay as officers or operating people. They dropped out and just became investors. They had their office. They were friendly with the Shanley people. They had their office then in the Empire State Building where Shanley was. Different floor, but within a floor or two of where Shanley, they had a suite of offices there. But they were just traders. They were not really operating people.
Can you give us a little personality character sketch on?
Mr. Gerngross was a very quiet man, small, gray-haired man, soft-spoken, very quiet. Schwartzhoff was a husky, real dynamic fellow, always just bubbling with enthusiasm about everything. He spoke very loud because he was deaf. He was rather noisy because of his deafness, but was a real gracious gentleman along with it. He always was very nice to me. He wasn't in Louisville very often. Mr. Gerngross would usually come to Louisville. Mr. Schwartzhoff did not come to Louisville very much. He was mostly stayed in New York. He would come down to Derby, and he would have a lot of his followers to follow him here to the Derby, because he would spend a lot of money. Some of his good customers, he'd bring their wives, and in those days there was gambling over in southern Indiana, and they'd go over to gambling rooms at night. He'd give these wives $1,000 to get in the crap game with, and stuff like that, I think. And I know he would often come to me, and he'd say, "Mr. Schaefer, will you please get me $2,000? I'm running out of cash." So I would send our messenger to the bank and get $2,000 for him, charge it to his account on the books, see. But this, he might do that every day while he was here. Sometimes he'd get $8,000, $10,000 on one trip, which he was passing around to his customers somehow. I don't know what he did with it. But anyway, he was always spending a lot of money. He spent lots of money. And Mr. Gerngross was very reserved. You didn't hear any of that out of him at all. They're very different personalities. But close friends, got along together beautifully. I will sidetrack just as a minute to show you about their personalities. I mentioned the flood. During the flood, Shaver and I had our first son, was a little fella, born in October, and this was February. So we went to Lexington because my brother lived in Lexington and had an apartment. I took them to Lexington to get away from the flood here. I wrote or wired or called or something. I don't know how I got in touch with them in New York to tell them where I was. And immediately, a special delivery letter came to the address that I'd given them in Lexington, enclosing a check for $250, a nice letter saying if I needed money, they were sending me this check. I didn't need money. I didn't ask for money. But I thought it was a very gracious thing to do. They were that kind of people. Very gracious people. Anyhow, we sold out to Shanley. They got out from the day-to-day operations in Shanley. Mr. Gerngross's nephew, Adolf Hirsch, who was here at this plant, became the manager of the plant. The man, Gabe Felsenthal, who had been manager since we started, at one time been a big owner, part owner of Shanley. And he and Rosensteel, Lou Rosensteel, had had a big falling out. And there wasn't anything nasty enough either one could say about the other. Here Shanley bought Bernheim. Well, that was the end of Gabe Felsenthal, of course. First thing Rosensteel did, he saw that Felsenthal was taken off the payroll. He was out. He was out instantly. And Hirsch was made manager. Felsenthal was a nice, big, noisy guy, and I always got along with Gabe real well. I had to cuss him occasionally because he'd cuss me, but I wouldn't take cussing. He pretty well, he was my best friend, even though he wanted to pick on me sometimes, but I learned I couldn't let him pick on me. I had him fire back just as hot as he fired at me. So we had some pretty hot words at times, but we always ended up friends. Hirsch became manager. A few years later, they decided they wanted Hirsch to come to New York, Shanley did. Watham Nabelkamp, who was a distiller, then became the manager. And Hirsch went to New York, and I commuted back and forth quite often to New York on business because I was running the accounting here.
Did Shanley adopt your accounting?
A great deal of the ideas that I had. They found that I had some very advanced ideas on accounting here that they didn't know anything about. Their accounting personnel, their auditors, field auditors, and people would come in here, and they'd go back to New York and tell me that they were just amazed at all this excellent records and knowledge that I had in the records here that they didn't know anything about. And they take it back to New York and get me up there to help them incorporate it in other plants. I was then asked by Sid Becker, Sidney Becker, who was then treasurer in about 1938 or 9, wanted me to come to New York and head up one of the top jobs in the accounting department for Shanley, which I refused to do. And I continued to live in Louisville and then was made assistant manager for this region. Still, I was unhappy here because accounting and finance was my life, and it wasn't here any longer. And I started making a move to get away, and finally, in 1942, I resigned and became treasurer of American Air Filter Company and left the distillery industry. So I have been out of the industry now for 42 years, and haven't kept up with what happened. There's been a lot of regulations changed, a lot of laws changed, a lot of operations changed. I'm sure that today it doesn't even resemble what I knew 42 years ago. But taxes were always a big problem. Nobody understood taxes on whiskey. I had the experience before I went in 1933. Frankfurt Distilleries was trying to get reorganized and going, and they had a big financing deal going on with a banking firm in New York. They sent a New York accounting firm, which was then known as, which is now Touche Ross and Company, it's Touche Nevin and Company then, down here to make an audit, this New York banking firm. And one of the New York managing partners, Victor Stempf, was in charge of the job. He later became president of the American Institute of Accountants. I was working on the Frankfurt deal, and I worked with the Touche Nevin crew, five or six men, because they couldn't understand the records at all. They couldn't understand anything about taxes, and that was a big bugaboo to them. So I spent a great deal of time with Victor Stempf of Touche Nevin, educating him on how you handle whiskey taxes and how you report them. And I went over all of that with him. He would think he had it, and a week later he'd come back and say, Ben, I wish you'd go over this with me again. I'm still confused. It was a very involved operation. The whiskey had been moved around from warehouse to warehouse and county to county during Prohibition. The old whiskey I'm talking about now. Mm-hmm. And the ad valorem property tax did not have to be paid until that whiskey was taken out of bond. It accumulated. So sometimes you'd take a barrel out of bond in a warehouse here in Louisville. It might have been part of its life in two other counties. So you had to know where all it had been residing, on what dates it had resided where, so you could pay the county for the assessment date on the assessment dates when it resided in that county. Mm-hmm. This got to be a horrible job.
Well, the county's usually pretty accurate in what they believe to be the payments owed to them.
They took whatever you gave them and didn't know anything.
I had that suspicion.
They didn't have the foggiest idea whether it was right or wrong, I'll tell you that.
So you were somewhat of a Santa Claus at times, I imagine.
That's right. Now, the companies and all of my experience and the people that I worked with were honorable people, and we tried to be absolutely honest. You see, here was the thing. This was dynamite if trouble came out. Whiskey was really like fooling the dynamite. The social aspects of it, mm-hmm. And you had to be very conscientious and very careful to not be involved in any scandals mm-hmm. That the public mm-hmm. would pick on you with. Mm-hmm. So this was very careful.
Were you approached frequently by politicians?
No, I never. Others. I'm not saying that they were the mm-hmm. executives or top executives may have been. I was not. No, mm-hmm. I was never approached by anyone. Not at all. It is all on the up and above board. Now, but this whole system went on like that. There was a production tax of 5 cents a gallon levied by the state.
Under the first Chandler administration?
No, it came in at about the time, that is earlier than the Chandler, I think, well, yes, because he was governor right after repeal. I think it came in just about the time of repeal in 33. The 5 cents a gallon. I believe that probably even after I left the industry, it went to 10 cents a gallon. I don't know when.
During the second Chandler administration in the mid-50s.
Well, I was out.
To 10 cents per gallon.
Yeah.
But can you talk about the impact of that 5 cent production tax to the impact to the state, locally, and to the business?
Well, it produced an awful lot of revenue for the state of Kentucky, I can tell you that. When you take Bernheim, when we were making say 450 barrels a day, for easy arithmetic, I'll use 50 gallons. It's not quite that, about 48 gallons to the barrel. That's 200 and some odd thousand gallons a day. At a nickel on 200,000 gallons is $10,000 a day or so, isn't it? That's a pretty nice revenue for the state. We were paying the state at least something over $10,000 a day in production tax on that one distillery. Now, we weren't the largest distillery in the state by any means, but this was a big revenue producer, no question about that.
Do you believe that the 5 cent production tax largely took the place of the sales tax, as you recall Governor Chandler repealed?
No, he put in the income tax in his first term. He replaced the sales tax with an income tax. He's the father of the state income tax. I think he replaced the sales tax that had been in existence. It hadn't been in very long.
No.
He didn't believe in that. He believed in the income tax. Mm-hmm. And I think it replaced income tax.
You think the income tax really was
that's right.
Not the
and of course, tax. This came along. The state, when he... Well, this has not much to do with the liquor business, but I happen to also made many audits around the State Department up in Frankfort mm-hmm. in my accounting days, the Highway Commission and other deals in the state. Before Chandler's first administration, it was the most deplorable operation I've ever seen in my life. Mm. Talk about bad records or no records. They exist. That's all there was up there, no records. You couldn't find out anything. The state... At that time, the Constitution did not permit them to create debt. However, there was some unknown quantity debt outstanding. It's thought to be about $25 million. If you sold the state of Kentucky some merchandise, they didn't have money to pay your bill. So they gave you a scrip, an interest-bearing scrip, that would be called and paid whenever they got some money. Now, if you wanted your cash, there was a market for about 80 cents on the dollar for this scrip. So what you did, if you were a smart businessman, you raised your price to the state so you could sell your IOU for 80 cents and get your regular price. And the state was paying through the nose for everything they were buying. There was one of the state treasurers, when they got some money, the state treasurer was supposed to reach in the hat and get out scrip to be retired. He was one of the buyers of scrip. Somehow or other, he'd always get hold of his scrip when he'd reach in the hat. Along the way, the federal government entertained him at one of their country club establishments for 2 years or so, 5 years for fraud or income tax fraud or something. Anyway, but it was really a terrible mess up there. But that had nothing to do with the liquor business. Governor Chandler came in the state. He was going to pay off the debt and leave the state solvent. Nobody thought it was possible to pay off $25 million in 4 years. He not only paid it off, but he left a surplus in 4 years.
Sure.
I'm going to put in a plug here. Mm-hmm. In my way of thinking, that was the best 4 years administration Kentucky's ever had. And I take my hat off to Happy Chandler. I didn't think so much of his second term, but the first one was fabulous. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's see. Where
what
are
about
we?
That 5% production tax for the industry as a whole?
Now, I don't
some
think it
was. Told me that it was totally detrimental to the industry.
I don't think it was at all. Mm-hmm. I don't think it chased distilling out of Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. What about the argument that it chased? Okay. Maybe we should pick up where we had left off there about the production tax, because we didn't really finish that. Can we go over that again?
Yeah.
My question is this, whether the fact that there was a 5 cent production tax actually adversely affected the industry, not so much in terms of bourbon, but in terms of other alcohol distilled products.
I doubt it very much. That's my personal opinion, and I may be dead wrong, but from the people that I knew in the old time, the people that went back in the liquor business here, were dyed-in-the-wool bourbon manufacturers. They weren't interested in alcohol, gin. Of course, I'd never heard of any such thing as vodka in those days. Gin was the only alcohol-based thing that I knew anything about. There was people who had been in what was known as the rectifying business would buy bourbon and add alcohol to it and rectify it. They'd take a bourbon to add color and flavor to alcohol in what was known as rectifying. Now, the distillers didn't ordinarily rectify, as I understand it, but that was mostly done in liquor dealers, Chicago, San Francisco, Philadelphia, New York, all over the country. There were rectifying plants. They would buy the bourbon from the distillers here, and they'd buy alcohol from someone else and rectify it or put them together. Now, there was some whiskey, what was known as heavy-bodied whiskey, made. At Bernheim, one time, we made a few thousand barrels of pure malt whiskey, all out of malt. It was real syrupy stuff. Wasn't fit to drink. Heavy, heavy, heavy. It was made for rectifying because it worked wonderful with alcohol to make a palatable drink that tasted like whiskey. I don't know in what proportions you would mix it. We ended up selling all of our malt whiskey to Seagram's to flavor up some of their trash. I don't know what to use it for, but we sold all of our malt whiskey to Seagram's one time. got rid of it.
Blends.
For blends. Well, blend, rectified and blend are two different terms. A blend is, as I always understood it, is a mixture of two whiskeys, two ages, or two distillations. Rectified is whiskey and alcohol. I think that's a technical term.
Yes.
I think the blends are one thing and they rectified isn't something else. I don't think rectified ever...
I
don't know whether any of it's done anymore or not.
I just picked up that sometimes the blending was very loosely used as a term.
Yes, that's right. That's right. No, I don't... I doubt if the production tax had any real dire effect on the total liquor industry in Kentucky. Oh, everybody yelled about it. Of course, you yelled your head off everlastingly about it. But, of course, it was a fairly significant part of your cost at one time. At one time at Bernheim, in the later 30s, I think we were making whiskey for about 35 cents a gallon, including the barrel and the now that did not include the 5 cent tax. That was on top of that. But including a barrel, a whiskey barrel now costs 40 or 50 cents a gallon to put it, just the barrel alone. I don't know what a whiskey barrel sells for today, but we bought them for $5. That's 10 cents a gallon for barrels.
I've been told over $60.
Yeah, that's right. So that's over, that's a dollar and something a gallon just for the barrel. We were paying $5 for barrels and producing whiskey for 35 to 40 cents a gallon. We were distilling corn at about 35 or 36 cents a bushel. We used to consider good operations would produce about 4 3/4 gallons per bushel of grain. That was a kind of a seat-of-your-pants standard, mm-hmm. Not real scientific or anything, but that was that was considered a fair yield, about 4 3/4 gallons per bushel of grain you mashed. So we were now when we sold warehouse receipts at Bernheim, the 5 cent production tax followed the whiskey, and when they took it out, we collected the 5 cents back. From whoever bought the whiskey had to pay us the 5 cents over and above the price we sold for. What else? Okay on that?
Yeah. We've talked previously about Lou Rosensteel. I was going to ask you next if you would share some of your Lou Rosensteel stories with us.
Well, he might rise from the dead and smite me. I don't know. But... Lou Rosensteel was raised in Cincinnati. He had an uncle by the name of Johnson. And he had a distillery at Milton, Kentucky. It was a little distillery. Milton's across up the river here, across from Madison, Indiana. And Louis Johnson, his uncle, owned a distillery at Milton, Kentucky. And as a young man, he worked for his uncle. And I told all of this. This is stories that I didn't know. I didn't know him then. I didn't know Louis Johnson. But he worked for down in the distillery rolling barrels and as a laborer working around his uncle's distillery. It was a very small operation, apparently. Probably make it 10 or 15 barrels a day or something like that. During Prohibition, he was in Cincinnati, and there was a bunch of pretty big bootleggers operating around Cincinnati. And he was always suspect, and I don't know whether this happened in the group, that they went out and bought several small distilleries. And mysteriously, the whiskey all disappeared from those small distilleries. So he was always suspect of being in the gang that stole their own whiskey from some small distilleries. So far as I know, including the one at Milton, Kentucky, was involved in that deal. There's a lot of small distilleries in Kentucky at one time, and the best known gangster in that crowd was named Remus, George Remus. The government finally,
I knew one man by the name of Landon. He was appeared to be a right nice guy, but the government one time gathered them all up and had a big trial and convicted 15 or 20 of them and sent them all out to Leavenworth Penitentiary, sent a trade load of them. Remus and my friend Landon was on that train. Lou Rosensteel's, he didn't get caught in that crowd at least. He wasn't on the train when he went to Leavenworth. So
he was out of town, wasn't he?
He was out of town or something. I don't know what happened. These are just rumors. I don't know if there was any truth in any of this. I do know that Landon went, I know Landon was on the train and went to Leavenworth. That I know for a fact, because he was a friend of some of the people in American Medicinal, and I got acquainted with him in 1928 out there. Anyhow, but Rosensteel put together, finally, Shenley, with a number of small companies, small distillers. It wasn't a very big, it's a little, when up until repeal came along, it didn't amount to very much. And he'd gotten in Pennsylvania, and there's a distillery at Shenley, Pennsylvania, where he used the name, picked up that name. But I don't know anything about the plant. I never was at the plant in Shenley, Pennsylvania. It was built into a big plant later on, but it was a small one. Everything was quite small, and I don't think they had very much whiskey when repeal came on. I don't honestly know. He was a tough egg to deal with. I saw him three or four times, I guess, which was as many as I cared to. He was never in Louisville, to my knowledge, to our plant here, but one time. He came in that one afternoon. Nope, we didn't know he was in Louisville. He wasn't looking for him at all. Wathen Naval Camp was the manager. And the races were here, and Wathen had gone to the races. Lou Rosensteel blows in, and a taxi cab had a cab waiting out front for him. Switchboard receptionist called me and said, "Mr. Shaver, Mr. Rosensteel's in the lobby." I said, "Oh, my God." So I went out to see Mr. Rosensteel, and I covered up for Wathen. I don't know whether I ever did tell him where Wathen was, but I just said he wasn't at the plant that minute. He wanted to see through the plant, so I took him on a quick tour of the plant of about 30 minutes, and he got in the cab and left, and that's the only time I ever saw him in the plant. I saw him a few times in New York.
He liked you, right?
Well, I don't know whether he liked anybody or not. He didn't fire me, at least. He liked me well enough not to fire me, at least. That's all I could say. I would say he probably didn't know me well enough to know whether he liked me or disliked me, honestly. So that was fine with me, as long as I didn't have to. He ran a madhouse in Shenley's office in the Empire State Building. It was an utter madhouse. He would want to come into the office sometime in the middle of the afternoon. He'd expect his executives to stay there, and he got to go ready to go home maybe at midnight. And they'd been there since 8 o'clock in the morning. And these poor boys in this accounting department, one reason that I told Sid Becker I wouldn't go near the place, I knew what was going on. Those poor guys in the accounting department, some of them stayed there all night all the time, because Lou Rosensteel would come in there and demand reports at 10 o'clock at night, and things like that. And gradually, a lot of those people, a number of my friends ended up with nervous breakdowns in there and had to get out, one of them being Sid Becker. He got promoted up to president and then had a nervous breakdown over it. There was another nice friend by the name of Earl Gassenheimer. He succeeded Becker's treasurer. Same thing happened to him. He had a nervous breakdown and had to get out of the bank. So he ran a thorough madhouse. I never heard anybody in the office didn't tremble at every word he said. And he was a dictator, but this business of just totally no regard for the comfort of the employees that worked for him at all. Very dictatorial. I saw him the last time I saw him, and one of the last times, I guess, that I was in New York with Shenley, about as close to the time that I got out of. I was up in Mr. Schwartzoff and Mr. Gerngross's office. I'd gone up that morning,
had worked all day in the accounting department on what the problems were that I had to deal with. And in normal quitting time, say at 5 o'clock or 4:30, whenever it was, I went up to Mr. Schwartzoff and Mr. Gerngross's office for a little social chat. And we were having a very nice chat because I always enjoyed sitting and chatting with those two men. When Mr. Schwartzoff, valet Clarence, came in and said, "Mr. Shaver, Mr. Rosensteel wants to see you." I said, "Clarence, I don't know where Rosensteel's office is even. I know it's in the Empire State Building, but this is a big building." He said, "Well, come on, I'll take you. I know where it is." So Clarence took me over to Rosensteel's office. And he had a big table over in the conference room and all these people sitting around it. My friend Gassenheimer was sitting there. And when I went in, guy I said was present earlier.
Becker?
Not Sid Becker. Sid wasn't there. Anyhow, he'd been president, and I'd known here at American Medicinal Deal. He was sitting there. When I walked in the door, he got up and he said, "Ben, I didn't know you was in New York. So glad to see you, and very gracious to me, you see." Gassenheimer, I'd been to Gassenheimer all day. He knew I was there. And the credit man and the cashier, who was one of Rosensteel's buddies, it was 8 or 10 of them around the table, and he had some questions about these notes that we'd taken for whiskey and who was collecting them and so forth, and wanted to know what I was doing about it. I said, "I'm doing nothing, Mr. Rosensteel. I was instructed about 2 years ago to bring them to New York and turn them over, which I did. Mr. Popkin, the cashier, gave me a receipt for about $5 or $6 million worth of that paper, notes and warehouse receipts, and I presume that your organization here has been handling it. I don't know a thing about what's happened to it, sir." Well, of course, then some of those guys were on the hole to crawl in or sitting around the table. I put some of these guys in a hell of a hole, I'll tell you that. But he said, "Well, thank you, Mr. Shaver. You can be excused."
Glad to get out.
I was gone, and that was my last encounter with Lou Rosensteel. I'd had all I needed right there.
Mr. Schaefer, would you discuss in some detail the regauging and the taxation structure for the period that you were involved?
Well, when whiskey was is being dumped for bottling, you take the barrels out of the warehouse. The storekeeper gauger, again, is in charge of everything. And under the old Carlisle allowance, which was in existence up until the time I left the industry 42 years ago, each barrel stood on its own. Let's take it as an example. A barrel that started out in life with 48 proof gallons of liquor. 4 years later, you take it out and going to bottle it. The storekeeper gauger weighs the content, checks the proof of the content, and based on the table, you get an allowance of so many gallons for evaporation that has disappeared during the 4 years that this barrel has been in storage. Now let's just assume that here is a barrel that started out with 48 gallons in it. When we regauge it, it has 38 gallons. The Carlisle allowance table said it should have 39 gallons. So you're assessed the tax on 1 gallon that you don't have. You've got to pay as a minimum on 39 gallons. So you're assessed tax on this 1 gallon that you do not have in that barrel. The next barrel you come to, when you gauge it, it's got 40 gallons in it. Carlisle allowance says that you could be down to 39. However, you have to pay tax on the 40 gallons. In other words, you cannot offset the shortage of one barrel against the overage in another barrel. Each barrel is a unit in itself.
And so you lose the both coming and going in that situation.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you recall when the Carlisle allowance was stricken?
No. It's after my day. You see, I don't know what's that. I didn't know what happened after 1942 in the details at all. Okay. I had other big problems to handle, and I rubbed all of that out of my mind.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. I thoroughly enjoyed this. Your answer.